Welcome to our podcast, Microbes in Us, brought to you by the Federation of European Microbiological Societies. I am Joseph.
And I am Eleni.
And we are the hosts of Microbes in Us.
This podcast brings together the people that work tirelessly to uncover and understand the microbial world, its secrets, its complexity, and its vibrancy.
And it will show us how microbes can shape, break, and make our human world.
From prehistoric times,
all the way to the modern world around us.
We hope you enjoy and share this podcast.
Hello to all of our listeners and welcome to the special episode collaboration between Microbes in Us and the Microbe Moment. Today, our love for microbiology and science communication gets even bigger with the company of our two guests from the USA, Jonathan Mitchell and Elizabeth Dayette, which are actually the hosts of the microbiology podcast, The Microbe Moment. In this episode, we're going to talk about microbes in our food systems, so stay tuned for some interesting facts. Let's get right into it and meet our two guests.
Thank you so much for having us on Microbes in Us. We're so excited to be here. My name is Tess.
And I'm John.
And we are the hosts of The Microbe Moment, but we also have a pretty big science background ourselves. So I have a PhD in genetics, genomics, and bioinformatics, and I currently serve as a senior bioinformatics scientist at a startup.
And I have a master's degree in microbiology, and I'm currently a scientist and the laboratory director at a startup.
So before heading into the podcast, I think it's a great opportunity to get to know your podcast as well and some of your inspiration behind the platform that you have, the website and the blogs and everything. So can you share a little bit about this with us?
Yeah, of course. I'd love to. So the Microbe Moment really came from out of the pandemic where everything was really getting negative towards microbes. And there was a lot of bad press, I like to say, in microbiology in general, where a lot of people are talking more on pathogens and how we should destroy microbes. But I think there's a lot of untapped limitless potential within the world of microbiology, within the world of this unseen world beneath our feet. Always want to share my love for microbiology and just the potential these microbes can have to help and aid in human society.
Yeah, we really focus on trying to show what different microbes do, not just for our own health, but for environmental health and even potentially engineering. Sometimes people can talk even about a battery. You know,
I think on our podcast, we do a lot of different things. So sometimes we talk about history and how microbes have shaped human history and has impacted our society now. Sometimes we interview people in the field and the different careers that they have. And sometimes we just talk about our favorite foods, or a lot of times we'll also talk about how microbes play a role in science fiction or in some of our favorite TV shows.
We really like to show like how cool microbes are and maybe even potentially inspire some people to find their own microbe moment.
Because everyone has one.
Yep.
That's so nice to hear. And this actually is a great line for me to say that actually today we're going to talk about how microbes are involved in food production. So we hope to be able to surprise you basically in this episode with some facts that you don't really know. Tess or Jonathan, you want to head first with your facts, but the floor is yours.
Yeah, so I'll go first because mine is actually before food gets on your plate. I think we often forget how much microbes play a role in the actual creation of the food that we love so much. So I want to talk more about plants and their need for probiotics and prebiotics. So plants, they grow in the ground, right? That soil is covered in microbes, and those microbes can aid in the health and the protection of the plants even prior to when they get into the store, prior to when you pick up the food for your own consumption. So broadly speaking, plant microbiomes can be divided into three compartments. You have what is called the rhizosphere, and these are all the microbes that are sort of attached to the roots or around the root area. And then you have the above ground, that's sometimes the phylosphere, the microbes that are on the leaf. There are also the endosphere, which is what I spent a lot of my time in my PhD thinking about and researching. And the endosphere is really these microbes that live inside of the plant. And they can live in the water transport system of the plant, they can live in the food or nutrient transport of the plant, or they can just kind of be hanging out in the interior of the roots as well. This is often, we see this with arbuscular mycorrhizae fungi. These are super helpful fungi that live in the rhizosphere of the plant and can help them grow and be strong and healthy. But what I think is really cool about microbes in the plant system is similar to our own gut microbiomes, they can help in protection and increase their own health. So they do this by creating hormones, or they can induce systemic resistance, which is a sort of way of immunity for the plants. And they can even create antibiotics to fight against other pathogens. One of the main hormones that microbes create for plants is called ACC deaminase. And this is really important in root growth or shoot growth, as well as lowering ethylene levels, which is a stress response in plants. So a lot of these microbes that are considered helpful or beneficial to the plant are called plant growth promoting endophytes or plant growth promoting bacteria. There are microbes that can help the plant grow, help them create these hormones that eventually help their health. But then you can also have microbes that are antagonistic towards pathogens. And these are your microbes that we can call biocontrols. They're living organisms that are antagonistic towards something that is not helpful or is harmful to the plant. And they produce antibiotics to either destroy the pathogen. They can have niche exclusion, which means they're taking up the same space in order to survive. So they're literally pushing a pathogen out of a specific space, or nutrient exclusion as well. If they're eating the same things and they're better at finding those resources than the pathogen, they'll eventually tire the pathogen out. It won't be able to survive. And then you'll be able to control that pathogen, control the sickness in the plant, and then in the end have a higher yield and more food to go to stores and help with the global food insecurity issues. And I think this concept of biocontrols is really interesting now, but it's also a very old idea. For over 100 years, organisms like Trichoderma, Streptomyces, Penicillium, Aspergillus have been used to help protect our plants and our crops from pathogens.
Thank you for sharing that. It's actually when we were having the email conversation, you told me a lot that you're doing a lot of home brewing. So we talked about what happens before food gets into the supermarket or into our hands, but what does actually happen when food gets into our house? So can you share with us a few facts that you are maybe have experience in doing at your own home?
Yeah, so our listeners may be a little tired of me talking about this, but I do make mead.
We make a lot of mead in our house, actually. Our whole kitchen is just filled with carboys of mead and honey. We have so much honey in the house, too.
Yeah, and I could talk to hours about this, but mead, some people may have heard honey wine. That's another name for it, and it's a very similar process to winemaking. And pretty much what you have is water, honey, and yeast, and that's the basis of making it. And so what you do is, you know, you have all these sugars from the honey, and you pitch the yeast like you would maybe making bread, and you would add it to this carboy, and then the yeast kind of go crazy and start fermenting it. And for those that may be unaware, you know, fermentation is really this like broad term of where a microbe takes something and then changes it to something else. But to our delight, this is making alcohol in this case. So I personally feel that mead lends itself to maybe the most versatile in terms of home brewing. I know you can make a lot of beers, but homebrewers of mead, you can use all sorts of different yeasts. You can use ale, lager, brewer's yeast. If you're brave enough, you can use wild yeast that you cultivate yourself, or the most common would be champagne or wine yeasts.
And what I think we found, which is so fascinating in kind of creating our own alcohol, creating this mead, is you can experiment with all these different kinds of yeast. There's over 200 different strains of yeast. Not all of them you can brew in. But when you take different strains of yeast and you brew mead in the same way, using the same water, the same honey, it will change the flavor. The microbe is actually impacting the flavor of the product that you're trying to create.
Right. I started out with this strain. It's called D47. It is the starters, but I switched over to another one called CY17 because it's known to give this floral taste, and I like to make meads that have a fruity taste to it, and I feel like it's a nice complement to it. So yeah, these yeasts are making alcohol, but they can add different flavors to them.
And home brewing and fermentation doesn't always have to be alcohol either, but it gives you this opportunity to really get to know different kinds of microbes. Like John was saying, the yeast D47 is very easy to grow. So it's usually added as a beginner's yeast because it's not that challenging to optimize it and to create the alcohol production from it. But other yeasts are a little bit more picky in what they like to eat or how they're going to grow or what temperatures they like to be at. And you really get to know the different kinds of yeast and the different flavors of yeast that are out there by sort of experimenting with the yeast that you buy.
So in a sense, is this something that anyone can do, or do you think there's a requirement for some knowledge beforehand or experimentation?
I think anyone can do it.
There are tons of resources out there to learn. Although if you're brewing mead or wine or alcohol, you got to be of age, of course.
Of course.
That's a requirement.
There's a little bit of reading that you do need to do to get yourself knowledgeable. And really, I think the biggest thing I would tell people is you got to get your sterile technique down. You don't want to accidentally contaminate your fermentation, because that can end up being very costly.
Yeah. And if you know somebody who does it, it can be a lot easier as a entry into the hobby if you're interested in getting into it. But there's also, you know, so many videos on it. I think we've taught maybe a dozen people how to brew mead, and we just have them come over and they come up with what they want to brew and what the ingredients they want to add. And we help them sort of create it, and then they get to take it home at the end of the day. So we've had non-microbiologists, microbiologists, people from other sciences come in and brew. So I think it is a really fun hobby and a way for anyone to be in touch with the microbial world.
And now it's a good time to bring my addition to this episode. And it's all about chocolate. And indeed, chocolate's characteristic flavor and aroma, and also its brown color, comes from microbes. Similarly to beer brewing, chocolate also gets its flavor due to fermentation by yeasts, in this case, and lactic acid bacteria. Now, speed lesson to chocolate production. It starts with the cacao tree, and on the cacao tree, there's yellow fruit that grows. When we break these yellow fruits, we can extract the cacao beans. And these beans are allowed to cure and drain for 3 to 10 days before drying in the sun. So in this curing stage is actually where the beans are fermented by yeast and lactic acid bacteria, which allow the beans to develop rich flavor, which come from the byproducts generated through the fermentation, and also its brown color. Then of course the beans undergo other processes like roasting and grinding or molding to the final chocolate we all know today.
Yeah, I think coffee is also very similar in chocolate, where you need microbes to brew it. I think most of people's favorite foods have a microbe to thank for that.
Yeah, cheese. You wouldn't have cheese without microbes. Pickling any food usually involves microbes. Even tempeh, you can't do that without microbes. Traditional soy sauce and even miso.
Yeah, and plus kimchi, kefir, yogurt, there's so many.
The list keeps going on.
Yeah, exactly. Perhaps, John, do you have another one that you would like to share with us?
I did look up mushrooms, really, or more specifically, fungus. I think most people traditionally don't think about mushrooms as microorganisms, but a good portion of our life is in this microscopic state. They start as spores and they're released, and they go to, you know, blow into the wind, they drop down, and then they start developing these, it's called a germ tube of multiple cells, and then they start splitting out into hyphae, which are these long little tentacle things. And really cool is these hyphae, they develop into something called a mycelium. These things actually help, which Tess had alluded to, other plants at this time, giving them nutrients, and then the plants give them nutrients. So it's like this really cool symbiotic relationship. And not only that, there's evidence that they may help plants talk to each other at this point in time. They're kind of like these messengers between plants. And then when they're ready to form or to reproduce, they form these fruiting bodies, and this is what we generally eat. So it starts off at these little microbes, and then you build into this delicious food that you can cook or put on a salad or whatnot.
Yeah, and just the other day we created the holy shiitake mushroom. We had that for dinner, and we actually had multiple mushrooms that we put on that, shiitake and maitake and trumpet mushrooms, I think, as well. And then we put truffle sauce on it, truffle goat cheese. It was a mushroom smorgasbord for sure. It was delicious. But I think mushrooms and fungi often don't get enough airtime, if one can say. In the world of microbiology, we talk a lot about bacteria. You talk a lot about viruses since COVID-19. But fungi are such a fascinating domain of life that we really don't know enough about to understand how helpful they are. I know also when we're discussing food, mushrooms, there are multiple companies that are now looking at mushrooms as a protein source and sort of being able to extract pieces of that fungi in order to create vegan proteins.
And I think people don't really realize how important fungus or mushrooms are for recycling matter in the environment. Like, they break down dead animals, plants, other things, and they bring that nutrient back to the soil to be used by other plants.
They really are at the start and at the end, I think, of all life cycles, microbes in general.
I think a really interesting thing that I found out recently is if you go to the produce section and you look at mushrooms, they're really the only ones that make vitamin D that you can eat, which is something I didn't think about, but it kind of blew my mind. I'm like, yeah, nothing else really makes vitamin D except us.
And there's all sorts of stuff going on right now about mushrooms and their effects on behavior and mood. There you can get mushroom coffee and mushroom brain enhancers like lion's mane and reishi. Reishi is really well known for anti-inflammatory and for calming you down. So I think it's just a fascinating sort of piece of microbiology that's coming to the forefront in food sciences right now.
And I know you, Elizabeth, you were doing some research actually on the microbiome of grapevines. So do you have any interesting facts to share with us about that?
Did my PhD sort of looking at the endosphere, the microbiome of grapevines. And I think it's funny that a lot of people ask me, you know, did I get a lot of free bottles of wine? And I did not. We would go out to the fields, to the actual grapevines, and collect our samples from the plant itself. And we were really interested in understanding whether or not we could find a microbe that could help aid in the plant's defense against a pathogen called Zeila fastidiosa. Now, Zeila fastidiosa is a tragic disease for grapevines. It ends up killing the grapevine. You have to pull it out. And this is really expensive for the vineyards. And it makes you lose a lot of wine over time because it makes the berries desiccated. It makes the canopy not as full. So you're not going to get as much yield. And so my PhD really looked at, can we find microbes from roots to shoots? Can we see if they're traveling throughout the plant? Are there similarities in all these different parts of the plants? And we could. We could find a lot of microbes that were shared in the roots, that were shared in the above ground microbiome as well. And we actually did find a few microbes that seemed to suppress the pathogen and help the plant defend itself against Zeila fastidiosa. So this could be a really cool way in the future to sort of mitigate our dependency on pesticides, which can have a lot of harmful effects both to people's health and also to the surrounding environment. So if we can find these sort of natural ways in order to suppress disease or to become less reliant on harmful chemicals, I think it could be a game changer for fight against climate change and our hope to having a greener tomorrow.
And so talking to you guys today, actually, one of the questions that I get asked by people in their early career or people thinking about going into science and microbiology, what inspired you to actually go down in this field? How was your journey to get until you are now? The second part of my question would be, what has drawn you to starting science communication as a hobby? Or I don't know if you are guys doing it as a part-time job or your full-time job. So what's your status at the moment?
I mean, it feels like a full-time job. But really, it's just a very involved hobby, I would say.
I come from a family, several generations were in the medical field, and that's what I was leaning towards. But I took a microbiology class as a prerequisite, and I kind of fell in love with microbiology from then on. And I originally went for nursing, but I went and got a bachelor's degree in medical microbiology. Yeah, each class I took, I really fell in love with it more and more and more. What impressed me is like how long we've been living with these microbes. Sometimes they're good, sometimes they're bad. A lot of times they don't do anything, but these interactions are mind-blowing to me, especially when I got into the world of the microbiome.
Yeah, and for me, I would say it's a little bit more philosophical in a lot of ways. So I didn't really intend to go into microbiology until about my second year in college when I took this microbiology course. And I come from a very small town, from a very small state in New Hampshire. And it was just this idea that a single microbe or these microbes can work together and do something so powerful, whether it's powerful in a sort of bad way like pandemics or powerful in a good way like helping us with growing our agriculture, helping us grow our plants or protecting us from our or training our own immune system. These small things can have such a big impact. And I like to just think, like, even though I come from a small town and I'm a small person, maybe I can have a big impact like microbes someday.
Thank you for sharing that. I just wanted to give you guys both the time if you wanted to share anything with our audience, something completely different, something personal, or to share maybe how people can find you.
One big thing that I would say is we are trying to shift the mindset of how people view microbiology, our microbes themselves, and we have evolved with these microbes. We're living with them every day, and don't be afraid of microbes. We work together. That would be my biggest takeaway with microbiology.
Yeah, humans and nature and microbes, there's an interconnectedness that we need to find some peace and harmony with for sure. But yeah, you can find us at Microbigals, MicroBigals, both on Twitter and Instagram. We do have our blog. We accept guest blog posts if you would like to write for us. We do on almost any topic. So if you have a topic that you want to write about that has to do with microbes, you can go ahead and email us at microbigals@gmail.com. And we'd love to work with you and create a blog or to come on the podcast.
And that brings us to the end of this episode. I hope you were able to learn something interesting about microbes in our food processes that you didn't necessarily know. And thank you to both you, John, and Tess, and Microbigals for joining. And thank you to our listeners who stayed with us until the end. See you next time.